Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
You pop craze youngsters, and welcome back to part 3 of episode 70 of Chart Music. I'm Al Needham, there's Sarah B and Neil Kulkarni, and we are plunging the fist of analysis into the cow's ring piece of an episode of Top of the Pops from April the 17th, 1986. We've only gone wrist deep so far, but in this part, we're going right up to the elbow, so please step back a bit, because it's going to get proper messy from here on in. Onward!
They're about to start on their first world tour, Australia, next month. And also, we'll see them here in this country in December. Right now, here's some closer look at the charts. It's the Top 40 Breakers. And up 13 places to number 27 is Suzanne Vega and Marlena on the Wall.
Davis on a stage with an applauding hand in the bottom corner, which is the nearest we've seen of an actual audience member so far, tells us that AHA are off to Australia and we've got to wait 6 months to see them. He then pivots to the Breakers section, and first up is Marlena on the Wall by Suzanne Vega. Born in Santa Monica in 1959, Suzanne Vega was the daughter of a Swedish-German computer analyst mother and an English dad who divorced soon after she was born. 2 years later, after her man married the Puerto Rican teacher and novelist Eduardo Vega, she was relocated to New York and eventually studied dance at the High School of Performing Arts, the actual Kids from Fame school. While studying English Lit at Barnard College in the Aventis, she got properly stuck into the music scene of Greenwich Village, putting herself about at assorted folk venues, and in 1984 she landed a deal with A&M, was linked up with Lenny Kaye, the Nuggets compiler and guitarist for Patti Smith, and her debut LP, Suzanne Vega, was put out in May of 1985. It led to rapturous reviews in the American music press and a live review in the New York Times, which called her the Joni Mitchell of the 80s. This single from her debut LP was put out over here last year, but only got to number 83 in November of 1985. It's the follow-up, of sorts, to Small Blue Thing, which got to number 65 in January. It was re-released last month, entered the charts at number 92, then soared 31 places to number 61, and then took 3 weeks to nimbly scale the ladder to number 40. This week it soared another 13 places to number 27, and here she is on Top of the Pops for the first time ever in a minute and a half of video. More non-English people, what's going on? Well, here's a turn-up, chaps. Here's a lady singer-songwriter strumming away on an acoustic guitar in 1986. And in 1986, singer-songwriter means hippies and flares and peace, man.
The thing is...
What's going on here?
I think when you're this good, it doesn't actually matter what else is going on in the culture at the time. God, I fucking love Suzanne Vega. She's so New York, and she's such an intelligent and emotionally intelligent and exacting songwriter. and a really beautiful singer. And I mean, there are songs of hers that I can't think about without welling up, you know.
But it's precisely that it is 86 that necessitates this kind of thing. I mean, you can say, you know, what's a singer-songwriter doing in this period? But that's why, you know, I don't think Suzanne Vega is part of any folk revival, by the by. But, you know, a folk revival is a constant threat in a way. Because it always means the same thing. It always means a retreat into something small and intimate and personal, rather than the big and the universal and the stadium-sized. It's this desire not to be larger than life, but to be as small as life. And I think that's what Vega is appealing to in a big, big way. So it's, no matter how big and brash the era, there will always be people who come to success precisely because they offer an alternative to that.
She was a pretty big deal round about this time, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, five months from now, I'm going to be at a better college doing a drama and English course. And Suzanne Vega was fucking massive amongst all the women on my course.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she was right up there with Sylvia Plath. If Suzanne Vega had done a song called Fuck Off Ted Hughes, it would have been a fucking anthem at my college. And if you wanted to be around these girls, and you did, you better be prepared to listen to a shitload of Small Blue Thing and Undertow.
Well, no, it's just that Vega is one of the first artists that taught me that taste doesn't matter. And I don't mean that in a critical way of Suzanne Vega. What I mean is when I first met my missus, she was a huge Suzanne Vega head. And, you know, you realise at that point, look, shared taste isn't what compatibility is about. And actually, I got into Suzanne Vega because my wife played her a lot. And I just wanted to pick up on one thing Sarah said about the New Yorkness. I think that's hugely important.
Yes.
There's a real Seinfeld thing to Vega's appeal.
You know, every single character in Friends listened to Suzanne Vega before they actually moved to New York.
Yeah. And she's definitively a New York artist with all the attendant sort of references that go along with that, you know, coffee shops and diners and restaurants and bohemianism. But, you know, in interviews, she's a fuck shite sharper than these sort of characterizations, if a way. She was smart enough not to let her fame, and it was big fame, derail her, and she's still doing great, is Suzanne Vega. Who's buying this in 86 is, I'd say it's kind of Janis Long listeners a bit and Andy Kershaw listeners perhaps, but those pop listeners ultimately who want a bit more substance, I guess, not necessarily disgusted with modern pop, but they're not fully committed to going entirely underground. And actually, when you dig into the songs on those first couple of albums by Suzanne Vega, she's a remarkable songwriter.
This is one of my favourites of hers because I'm just that basic, but I mean, I know that she thinks of it as like sort of juvenilia now, but she's a songwriter who sort of writes about emotional truth and will draw on her own life experience without necessarily literally translating it into her songs. You know, some of them are like, I mean, Tom's Diner, I think, is really about a moment that really happened. But this, she said, is more broadly, it's about like coping with loneliness. And she did actually have a poster of Marlene Dietrich, movie goddess, activist and rampant bisexual badass on her wall. She didn't necessarily have what sounds like a succession of one night stands under it. But it's a pretty good way to illustrate the feeling of being deeply alone in yourself, this kind of line of anonymous dicks, you know, it's like the loneliness of the long distance shagger. It's quite a sort of student-y song. In a way. I mean, it's in the best way. I mean, for me, it always sounded like she's sort of communing with this poster, which is smirking down at her, possibly for only doing it with boys when there are so many hot girls out there, darling. What are you doing? She's drawing strength kind of not from the sex and not from the wall art, but from, you know, the depths of herself. And I think it's about being sort of young and ridiculous and not finding fulfillment in the usual young person shit, but seeing a way ahead beyond that. Because not everybody suits being young either. Like, I definitely didn't make the most of it because I was just like, it's like there's a certain awkwardness, like this time in my life doesn't fit and I kind of want to get past it, you know. So, like, just seeing a way ahead to, like, maturity and authenticity and a bigness of self that you don't get in a skinny student bed with a mattress like a slice of sunbless.
No.
She's usually appealing to the awkward. When she's touring this year, when she plays in Manchester, she says to the audience it's really special for her to be in Manchester because it's Morrissey's town. And I think there is that appeal. And look, there's no point hiding it. I sort of quite fancied Suzanne Vega in 1986.
Oh, yeah.
The trouble was, what I found when I used to read interviews with Suzanne Vega is that interviewers, especially male interviewers, they did the usual thing of not failing to mention her appearance. You know, they had to do that. But then they almost try and draw her into kind of criticising female pop figures. And Vega would do that. You know, when Vega's asked about Madonna, she's quite critical of Madonna and things like that.
Which is pretty ironic because she auditioned for Madonna's part in Desperately Seeking Susan the other year.
In a way, you know, going to the Fame School, I mean, not that it was called the Fame School, it was a very New York thing, and those things are going to be hugely appealing.
Yeah.
The New Yorkness is hugely important. And I think, you know, the Tom Steiner is the actual, you know, it refers to the exact restaurant that they use in Seinfeld, so that's why I make that connection in my mind.
Right.
To be fair to Vega, I think she was, like everyone else, is going to start getting sort of pigeonholed, start getting put into a certain category. She was always a little bit too smart for that, I think, and that's why she kept her sanity through this huge success, because I mean, this the album this is from, it goes platinum, you know, it sells a fucking lot of records.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in the UK sipping mugs of Gold Blend wishing that they were flicking through the Village Voice in a brownstone. Him out the Halifax advert showing off his new cash point card. He's probably got this on his CD player in his converted warehouse when he's got the ladies around.
Yeah, but I mean, she's great also at stepping into characters and kind of not making it a sort of whiny thing in any way. She's observant. And I think she's just a good writer. She knows how to observe. She also knows how to let other people speak in her songs. And consequently, you know, these things stick around a bit longer than it just being, hey, look, if you don't like what's going on in modern pop, this is different. That it sustains a bit longer than that. It's not just a reaction to what's going on. There's something unique about it in itself.
Yeah, it's just she's just so fucking beguiling. I can hardly stand it.
So, the video, A&M have dragged her into the 80s by running a bit of synthiness through the song and dropping another regulation 80s big jacket on her, because this is the time when all pop stars had to look like a five-year-old who's just broken into the dad's wardrobe.
The shoulder pads had got out of control at this point.
Oh, God, yeah. And that's juxtaposed with her doing as much of a sex as she wants to, which involves wearing a cocktail dress and adjusting her stockings and applying her lip hair. And there's an extra in Bonfire of the Vanities trying it on with her. She is being very much positioned as the anti-Madonna here, isn't she?
Yeah, there is a bit of that. She looks great. She looks great. The trouble is with this video, and it's not actually a problem with this video, it's a problem with its context in this episode of Top of the Pops, is I was watching it and I was just thinking, when's Gary Davis going to interrupt? When's Gary Davis going to interrupt? How long is this going to last? How long is this going to last? You know?
Never mind that. Here's my shopping list for tomorrow.
And that sense of rushness that they've actually got too much to actually fit into half an hour, so it's going to be a bit breakneck. It just makes it not for a relaxing or even exciting experience in a sense, because you just think this is going to get spoiled. Much as a daytime DJ is going to talk over the best bit of a record, something's going to happen here that's going to annoy me.
Yeah,
but she's put over far better in this video than she would be on that neon step.
I'm not entirely sure that would have worked at all.
No,
especially if the lights were in their full pelt, kind of swirling around thing.
Yeah,
and what would the crowd do? I mean,
well, we don't see him anyway, so who gives a fuck?
She would definitely have looked out of place and it would have felt uncomfortable, even though she's got that very above it cool that, you know, can cope with anything.
Yeah, and crucially, I don't think Vega ever came across really as perhaps what Andy Kershaw or somebody might have said about her. You mentioned actually the word, Sarah, authentic. There is an authenticity to Vega, but she's also, I'm not saying authentic about her inauthenticity, but there's mystery there as well. It's not just, you know, here's my soul, here's everything uncovered. There's something playful and poetic about what she does that keeps her interesting, I think, rather than just being, you know, here's something I forged in the smithy of my soul. It's a bit more thoughtful and playful than that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, a time in the chart was fleeting, but you could argue that she kicked the door back open for the likes of Tracy Chapman and Katie Lang and Tori Amos and all that lot.
Oh, undoubtedly, because each one of them will be compared to her almost immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the laziness as well. I mean, it's kind of what you said, you know, she's the is Joni Mitchell. She's not. She's absolutely not, really.
No one can be. The Joni Mitchell of the 80s was Joni Mitchell.
Well, if there was a Joni Mitchell of the 80s, it was probably actually Prince. But, you know,
yes.
this is the laziness of... it's what we were talking about earlier in that, you know, in that singles review page, lump all the female singers together under that title.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I don't like that either. However, I have to weakly defend it in the sense of, like, the fewer people there are to compare, then the fewer people there are to compare. You know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of the sin was committed, like, earlier, before it reaches that level. But also it's about stature, isn't it? It's not necessarily comparing musically, but once you get a bit of perspective on it and you go, okay, this person is up there with, you know, the greats. And I think it's fair, at that point, it's fair enough to talk about her in you know, the context of Joni Mitchell.
Oh, and it did the job. I mean, it got her signed. So...
Yeah, so it has its uses. Mm.
So the following week, Marlena on the Wall jumped 6 places to number 21, its highest position. The follow-up, Left of Centre, which was part of the soundtrack of Pretty in Pink and featured Joe Jackson on piano, got to number 32 in July, and she rounded off the year with Gypsy, only getting to number 77 in November. She roared back, sort of, in June of 1986 when Luca spent 2 non-consecutive weeks at number 23 and then spent the rest of the 80s as a bit player in the lower reaches of the top 100. But her biggest hit was DNA's remix of Tom's Diner, her 1987 single, which got to number 58 in July of that year, and it spent 3 weeks at number 2 in August of 1990. Held off number 1 by the more hardcore Turtle Power by Partners in Crime and the UK underground banger Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini by Bomb Ballerina. Oh, God. 1990, what were you like?
Yeah, she's reminding us all of that.
Tom's Diner Day is November the 18th, 1981. That's when it happened. That's when that devastating resonant moment that has been immortalised in song actually happened.
So it's like It Was a Good Day by Ice Cube. Someone worked out what day that was when the Lakers beat the Supersonics.
Exactly. It's in so many ways, it's exactly like that.
Good old Suzanne Vega. She had a nice cup of coffee and she didn't have to use her AK. Every soldier passing, but the only soldier now is me. Things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Just Say No.
This is the highest new entry on the chart this week, the anti-drug song, which is called Just Say No, at number 26, The Cast of Grange Hill.
Lower Mesopotamia in 3400 BC, opium began its career as a forage medicine for assorted ailments, which caught on throughout Asia and the Far East via imports from its label, the East India Company. In 1898, during a tour of Germany, Morphine, the front alkaloid of the group, teamed up with a biopharmaceutical company in Elberfeld to form an offshoot called Heroin. After starting its career as an over-the-counter morphine substitute cough remedy, which became very popular across Germany, Heroin crossed the Atlantic and started to collaborate with jazz musicians such as Billie Holiday, Ray Charles and Charlie Parker. By the 60s, Heroin started to take on rock influences, working with Eric Clapton, John Lennon, Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin before falling out of favour in the mid-70s. In 1977, however, Heroin supported Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers on their tour of the UK, which introduced it to a string of punk acts and underwent a revival, which was boosted by a deluge of cheap imports from Iran and Afghanistan that flooded the British market. By early 1984, Heroin, by now in its imperial phase, had become so popular throughout the UK, there had been an estimated increase of addicts numbering 40% year on year, with a Guardian report of the day quoting a government expert who said, LSD was a drug of the 60s. It was supposed to expand the mind to take in new horizons. Heroin is the drug of the 80s. It blocks out the pain and the hopelessness of unemployment and the bleakness of the future. Meanwhile, over in stateside USA, Nancy Reagan, the First Lady, who was looking for something to do when she wasn't telling a senile knobhead of a husband where to go and on what date, according to what her personal astrologer said, and allegedly giving Frank Sinatra a scene to when he was out doing those things, visited a school in Oakland, where she was asked by one of the kids about what to do if someone offered them the drugs. Taking her cue from an advertising slogan that was floating around at the time, she just said, "Just say no." While she was spearheading the anti-drug message over there throughout 1985, appearing on episodes of Different Strokes, Punky Brewster and Flintstone Babies, as well as the music video Stop the Madness, which featured New Edition, LaToya Jackson, David Hasselhoff, Herb Alpert, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Casey Kasem, Boogaloo Shrimp and Stacey Keach, whose appearance was edited out at the last minute when he was busted for coke, the BBC decided to pitch in, and in July of 1985 broadcast Drug Watch, a 2-hour, 10-minute melange of Crime Watch and That's Life, which combined Nick Ross telling us what drugs were, Esther Ranson having assorted interviews with parents of drug addicts, a panel of politicians and medical experts, and assorted celebrities. In one piece on Drug Watch, documenting how the Americans were dealing with the drug problem over there, they aired a clip of a music video, which was written by Al Gorgone, who played guitar on Leader of the Pack, Brown Eyed Girl, The Sound of Silence, Walk Like a Man and Chapel of Love, and George McMahon, who was working at the time with Denise Williams. The video was being aired non-stop on MTV and was entitled Just Say No. As part of the BBC's campaign against drug abuse, they enlisted the services of Grange Hill, which was formed in Northam, North London in 1978, and had immediately got into trouble with the BBC, parents, teachers and politicians for encouraging the youth to die in swimming pool accidents, put grasshoppers in Roland Sandwich and say flipping heck, but was rightly lapped up by the youth for depicting real kids' issues. Consequently, on January the 6th of this year, the 9th series of Grange Hill began with Zamo Maguire, played by Lee McDonald, showing off his new motorbike and attempting to rig the weight of Mr. Kennedy's moustache in order to win £6. Then he went on to sell his bike and started to ponce money off everyone, including Roland Browning, who now worked part-time in an amusement arcade where Zamo had been knocking about with assorted wrong-uns. And on February the 21st, the mystery was resolved when Roland found Zamo on the floor with a bit of foil in his hand, having chased the dragon and receiving a smack on the nose. Just over a fortnight ago, directly after the final episode of the current series of Grange Hill, where Zamo's been busted after being found with a wrap of smack secreted in his pocket calculator, Drug Watch aligned with Newsround and Grange Hill in a triforce of television drug prevention in the programme It's Not Just Zamo, which culminated with the world premiere of a cover of Just Say No, performed by the cast of the TV show, which was rushed out on BBC Records, with all proceeds going to the Standing Committee of Drug Abuse, otherwise known as SCODA. It came out last week and has immediately launched itself into the chart like a sausage on a fork, becoming this week's highest new entry at number 26. And here is a clip of the video. And oh my God, Pulp Craze Youngsters, I hope you've had a big tea, because we've got a long day ahead of us talking about this one. Fucking hell.
Indeed. A lot to talk about here.
So, heroin. Don't know what the fuss is all about. I can handle it. Just got a touch of the flu today. So, yeah, let's place ourselves back in 1986. I'm 17, Neil's 12, Sarah's 7 or 8. What did you know about drugs at the time?
Well, I mean, like you say, I was young, 12 going on 13. I hadn't really come across drugs. I'd had friends who'd done drugs.
At that age?
Yeah, kind of, I mean, not sort of serious drugs, and not silly drugs like paracetamol and a can of Coke either. You know, glue, butane, that sort of stuff. But in contrast to the way I became as an adult, I was kind of cautious about drugs before getting to drugs. Not because, I hasten to add, of things like Just Say No, but because of a cautionary experience that taught me that, you know, if I got out of my face, I'd get caught, just like I did with everything.
Right.
Because I got arrested by the British Transport Police.
No!
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Well,
how old were you?
I was about 13, 14. And,
all right.
Yeah, and I thought it was a bright idea to drink an entire bottle of gin at Memorial Park in Coventry.
Right.
And then went, for some reason, to the cafe at the station and woke up in a pile of vomit. And the British Transport Police, not proper coppers, but British Transport Police, they took me upstairs at the station and put me in a cell and phoned my mum. And so the sight of that cell door swinging open and my mum stood there silhouetted against the harsh light of Coventry Station, that kind of stuck with me. And
I
mean, she didn't actually bollock me. I think she realised the shame was enough. But yeah, that kind of put me off drugs a little bit. So Soap Bar and Red Leb and Speed and Acid and Mushrooms, they really only started becoming part of my life aged about 16. And at this point, when Just Say No comes out, beyond those few friends who did kind of glue and gas and stuff, I wasn't really exposed to drugs. But I do actually blame this record and the moral panic at the time and the inevitable way that getting back into 60s music makes you ever so curious about drugs. You know, what's this heroin this guy's singing about? Sounds Moorish. I blame all of that for my subsequent drug use.
Right.
But this did not help this record because it made straight edginess so uncool. So not loads of drugs knocking about my life at the time, but I blame this record for sending me that way.
Sarah?
Well, I mean, all the cool kids at my little West Yorkshire C of E village school were skagged up to the eyeballs at this time. We used to call them right bloody pricks, but as a compliment. One time, right, they raided the Brighouse and Rustic Brass Band practice room and found a kilo of primo Afghani brown with a street value of $2,000 stuffed into the euphonium. Of course, we were too young, so we just sniffed the Pritt sticks and dreamed.
All that Brasso line about those, Sarah.
Well, there was that. That was like the gateway drug for everyone. But yeah, I don't know. I was entirely innocent at the time. I was like all through school, really. Like, I don't remember, but I wasn't like one of the cool kids or even one of the uncool cool kids. You know, like people talk about, oh yeah, I was an outsider at school. Yeah, so you were cool then, actually. I was neither of these, so I had no idea. I don't remember either. I'm drawing a complete blank as to what, like, we got told about it or what we got taught about it. There must have been something.
Oh God, there was.
But I just don't remember.
I recall this period being you know, there's a growing barrage of propaganda about drugs in this period, of which this was the culmination, really, this record.
I'm 17 at the time, and I've got to admit, I knew and had experienced precisely fuck all. Like you, Neil, it was all glue round our way. But glue was on its way out by 1986.
It's weird, isn't it? Because when I think about walking around in the early 80s, the sight of glue bags was as common as kind of those gas canisters are now.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right, it was on its way out.
When I was 12, I had one sniff of my grandpa's tin of Bostick and spent the rest of the night in an absolute state thinking, well, am I going to die now?
Yeah.
I'd left comprehensive school in 1984, and the only bit of drug education we ever got was when Mr. Gallagher, our science teacher, spent an entire lesson telling us what happened to our bodies when we sniffed glue. And it was proper shit up, and it was fucking brilliant. And it's one of the two lessons that stuck with me throughout all these years. So good on you, Mr. Gallagher. But that was it at our school. The teachers might as well have said, you know, don't poke a fucking lion in the face with a stick on your way home tonight. Even now, in 1986, drugs are seen as something that only poshos and hippies did.
Who can afford them?
Around our way, it was just say what?
Just say eh.
I mean, around about this time, the nearest I got to drugs was going to Rock City or the Garage and seeing a group of lads in leather jackets who looked like they could be the support band, passing a needle about at the bar and pretending to inject themselves. But looking back now, it's obvious that it was all a cod and they were showing off because they were injecting it through the sleeves of their leather jackets. But it was like, I was proper terrified, just got to the other end of the club.
Yeah.
They just weren't a thing round my way.
I think this was probably, I was like too young to watch Grange Hill, but this was probably my first inkling that drugs were even a thing in the world, you know. And it was mysterious, and not in an alluring way, but in a sort of bemusing way. And I kind of got the message on some level, because it's, you know, as I'm sure we'll get into, it's so incredibly simplistic.
I mean, at school, I do remember a lot of people wanting to take sociology specifically so they could do stuff on youth culture, because that's where all the drug information was, and you were allowed to get the books that told you about acid and mushrooms and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it was definitely seen as something that people did in the past.
Yeah,
or just that people did elsewhere in gritty cop dramas and stuff like that.
Yes.
It was never kind of on the street or in front of you.
No.
Which makes the moral panic sort of like really quite odd at this time, and counterproductive, obviously. Unlike you, I did get some sort of drug education at school.
Right.
We got the propaganda from the government, basically, that before this campaign of Drug Watch, there is that one-off never broadcast Minder episode.
Yes.
A little bit of give and take, which is filmed and it's sent out. It's half an hour long, and it's actually the last time Cole and Waterman play those characters. The series had actually ended by that point, but they both decided to kind of do this because it's an important message. And this little mini episode of Minder is filmed, and it's sent out to schools by, you know, Norman Fowler at the DSF. And I recall it after that's disseminated to schools. I seem to recall watching this far more than I recall. Lenny Henry also had a little video that he sent out to school called Chasing the Bandwagon, which I don't think I've watched it. But a little bit of give and take, the Minder episode. I didn't like Minder, so I think I turned off around about, not turned off, but mentally turned off and started looking out the window about 10 minutes in.
If it had been Gideon says no to drugs, you'd been a bit more interesting, wouldn't you?
Indeed. Different kettle of fish, or Ludwig.
We've got to start with that episode of Drug Watch, because we've seen it, haven't we? Drug Watch today sounds like Bill Oddie observing some spices having a fight in a shopping precinct in Mansfield. But fucking hell, it's a remarkable document of the age, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's simultaneously sort of gogglingly odd because of the celebs involved.
Oh, yes.
But my God, it's deeply bleak as well.
It starts with Nick Ross standing next to a groaning table of drugs to show your man what you should be looking for in your pants drawer when you're out next. And, you know, including a line of cocaine, which apparently costs £15, next to some red and white striped straws like a dismembered Humphrey. And a chunk of ash that you could club an elephant to death with. It's a fucking 999 bar.
I was just waiting for him to sneeze, you know. just fuff it everywhere.
It does look like Sean Ryder's buffet table, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I love how he points out, he goes, this is marijuana, the leaves. It's like, mate, that is dill. You and the BBC have all been had.
But then we get some fucking horrific interviews with parents who have lost their kids to drugs, or are losing their kids to drugs, or are working out how to kill them if they ever come back in the house looking for something to nick to get drugs with. I mean, that's the That's Life segment of it. And that's fucking horrible.
Oh, God, yeah. When it steps outside of the studio and actually talks to people affected by the issue, fucking hell, this is the era of Threads, don't forget, and this is kind of just as depressing.
It's that colour palette, isn't it? That sort of dingy, sort of depressing look that these things have, and it's just, you know, and then the sort of weirdly, like, Esther Anson is such a strange presence. It's not that she's upbeat, but she's got this sort of light twittering voice. It's like, it was just really, really jingling my nerves.
Yeah, what a shame Cyril Fletcher wasn't there either, or Doc Cox, talking about some Jobsworth drug dealer.
I couldn't watch all of it, I have to be honest. It was so unhappy. It was awful. There was a woman who was talking about her son who died.
Yeah.
She's in the studio and Esther Anson goes and, like, there's an audience there and there's some guy who wants the mic, and the woman is like, well, I blame myself for my son's death.
Mm.
And Esther takes the mic over to some random who goes, yeah, I blame you too.
Yeah.
and no one says...
Insane, wasn't it?
No one says anything. There's no murmuring, there's no anything. Mm. It's so eerie. It's like ambient Jeremy Kyle.
And isn't David Mellor really small? You see him on this panel of politicians and he's fucking tiny.
Well, that's probably not his fault, unless, you know, maybe his mum did loads of drugs and that was her fault.
How did Antonio de Sancho get his fucking Chelsea shirt on?
Would have been a kid's size, I would have thought.
Yeah. Mind you would want it just over your head if you were being shagged by David Mellor.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, the thing is, Nick Ross is a deeply antagonising presence, I find. Mm. Him lecturing you, you just don't want it. Mm. It's simultaneously designed to do its job of saying the BBC are sort of like anti-drugs. And it keeps on saying as well...
Just in case you were wondering.
Yeah, we're going to give you the truth. We're going to give you a balanced thing. But it doesn't emerge like that. It emerges as being lectured by a load of grown-ups.
Yes.
And, you know, consequently, it doesn't really work.
Mm.
The celebs on it, though.
Oh, yeah, well... The end bit is just fucking remarkable. I mean, they announce a special guest near the end to sign a wall with Just Say No plastered across it. And you think, well, this is obviously going to be Nancy Reagan, because right about this time she would have pitched up on fucking Muhrenbusch Stanziger if she could have banged on to him about drugs. But no, it's Lady fucking Di.
It is.
Yeah.
Who signs the wall and then says nothing of worth to Esther, but still, fucking hell.
I know, it's a bit of a coup, that.
Yeah.
And it provides a sort of a kind of counterpoint to who we then see around this world.
Yeah, it's essentially a rounding up of the BBC bar, isn't it?
It is, basically.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, Diana kind of gets a pass from me forever because of what she did to break down the stigma of AIDS, you know.
Yes.
It is quite surreal to see her just kind of wander onto the set and say, well, of course, I thought this was a tremendously important subject and I just had to come and put my name to it.
Yes. She's a fucking angel.
Well, there is this reverence, isn't there, from everyone?
Yes.
And she has got star quality in terms of the kind of little hushed, reverent silence that happens.
I understand why she would do it. I understand why they'd want to get her, you know. Like, it is this whole thing, much as it isn't relevant to most people, I think you can feel the idea behind it is that they just want to hammer down on this to put the fear of God into the kids before they even start to really think about what drugs even might be at all. It is quite... BBC apocalypse, isn't it? Like,
she does draw on the fact that she's a mother and she's worried about her kids taking drugs.
Yeah, we know how they turned out, and I don't think drugs was what she needed to worry about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but the people, like, spotting the pic, because there's a crowd just milling about and people
just
chatting.
Just never ends. You have to watch it about five or six times to get everyone.
After Diana has signed the big drug watch wall, everyone else just gets a Sharpie and adds their signature.
I've got a list.
Yeah, me too.
With my chart music head on, the first person I spotted, of course, was Simon Bates.
Yeah.
He's accompanied by Noel Edmonds, John Peel, Terry Wogan, Susie Quattro, with a proper "Mam came back from Greenham Common and Dad started sleeping in the spare bedroom" haircut. Des Lynham, Lenny Henry, Sebastian Coe.
He's so oily.
I hate Sebastian Coe.
He's an oily man.
Yeah, he does look proper captain of the cricket team, David Watts style, doesn't he, there?
Yeah.
Adamant.
Yeah, chatting to Christopher Ryan.
Mike, the cool person. I'm so confused now. Yeah. But he's there to say, I don't want to say anything negative, but no.
Rolf Harris, who of course does a massive role for Roo. He does hog quite a large bit of that wall, doesn't he?
Surely a smackaroo would have had more impact. Like a horrifying human marsupial hybrid lying in a pool of its own vomit with a needle sticking out of its weird little arm.
We also have Alison Moyet, Mick Talbot, Colleen Nolan, Sarah Green, Fluella Benjamin out of a dustbin, Wendy Craig.
Oh, I didn't see her.
Ernie Wise, Barbara Dixon, Sandra Dickinson, Anna Carteret, Joanna Lumley, Pete Townsend, I think Emlyn Hughes, Bob Monkhouse, and of course, Jingle Nonce OBE.
Nigel Havers, did you mention him?
No.
Oh, he's there.
But there's also signatures as well from people who obviously were passing through the BBC and wanted to, you know, register their displeasure with drugs. They include Ian Dury, Sue Cook, Leslie Crowther, Sting, Paul Weller, Shelley and Mike from Bucks Fizz, Spike Milligan, Barry Cryer, Wendy Richard, Rula Lenska, John Craven, Samantha Fox, and Jonathan King. Fucking hell. Imagine if I was at home in a fucking bedsit taking smack. If I'd have known that Barry Cryer was against it. I mean, God love Barry Cryer, but fucking hell.
Yeah, it's an odd mix, isn't it?
And it's extremely odd mix.
And the thing is, like, all of these celebs, they're stood around, because once they've signed the wall, like, there's not a lot for them to do.
There's no refreshments. No. Like, let them at the buffet table that we saw earlier.
Yes. I think that's what brought half of them there, you know.
Too right.
Are they giving out party bags afterwards?
The thing is, to be totally fair, most of these people will be on the level and won't have done drugs. They'll have done worse things than much worse things, but, you know, but a lot of them won't have done. But Ian Dury, you know, I know that sex and drugs and rock and roll is not meant to be taken literally.
Yes!
But he liked a spliff, as I understand it. Yeah. He was a pothead, you know. My dealer, he's called Simon.
It was kind of disappointing seeing his name on there, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing was, you could say, oh, well, I'm just talking about heroin here.
Yeah, really specifically.
No one's going to say, well, you know, I do heroin. It's fucking me. What's the problem?
It's interesting as well, like, that to kind of see the pre-ecstasy landscape of drugs as well, because obviously ecstasy is on its way over in Mark Armand at this point. So, you know, this is going to hit soon.
There was a really good moment, by the way, in that It's Not Just Zammo Newsround special, where John Craven, I don't know whether it was scripted or not, but he adds to all these warnings, you know, that you shouldn't do it and it's dangerous, you don't know what you're getting and all this sort of stuff. But he flips back into an almost sort of Victorian thing. He goes, it will bring disgrace upon you. These messages are destined to fail because no matter how they tart it up and hide it, it's kind of, we're going to take an even-handed look at these things. It is just being hectored by grown-ups.
It's all very Catholic, I think. There's this drilling down to the sense of shame that they feel is what is going to ultimately motivate people. Shame and terror. Not even about the criminal aspect, but like the moral notion of like your sinful desires and the pollution of the body. You know, it's like only the corrupt would soil their person with these, you know, vile substances. It's like, really, there's some really, like, seriously grim shit.
So there we go. The celebrities sorting out the problems of the world once again. But now the big guns have been dragged out. Grange Hill. Chaps, did you partake?
I did. I loved Grange Hill.
Oh, yeah.
Early Grange Hill was great. Not because it was sort of what it set out to be and what it got complaints about. I mean, I went to school with people who were banned from watching Grange Hill by their parents.
Fucking hell.
But it really wasn't this gritty portrayal of real school life, but it felt like school. By which I mean the kind of laughs that you have to grab at school to fend off the misery and the corridors and the staircases and the beating zones and everything else. It did capture that kind of on the edge feel of school where you've got these preposterous rules and this mix of teachers, the bastards and the soft touches. In the Tucker.
What a cynic you are, Mr. Kulkarni.
You
speaking
know.
As a teacher.
But yeah, well.
Which one are you?
I'm definitely a soft touch man, soft as fuck. But it did capture all of that. In the Tucker Benny Pogo years of seasons 1 to 8, it captured all of that. But of course, by now, in 86, a lot of the founding characters are gone. The whole Tucker Doyley dynamic has been replaced by the Gonch Danny Kendall dynamic. And it's got a bit preachy with Zamo as this central Christ-like figure who's gone through this kind of druggy redemption. Where we find Grange Hill here, it always freaked me out at this point. It's kind of shedding its past. But Susan Tully still seems to hang around at school. Looking like Robert Smith, you know, running up against Bridget the Midget.
She turned up dressed up like Boy George, didn't she, episode?
But she just keeps saying to Bridget the Midget, you know, I don't go here now, I can wear what I want. But fundamentally...
I'm in EastEnders now, fuck you.
But fundamentally, at this point, the old guard have gone. And my watching of Grange Hill is going to taper off from here on in, really.
Yeah, I find that the older you get, as you progress through the comprehensive system, the less of a hold Grange Hill has on you because you've seen that it's a sham.
Yeah, completely. And what we see in Series 8 and 9, which straddle 85 and 86, I mean, we've got a new script editor, Anthony Minghella, who'd later make The English Patient. He brings more comedy in. Via Gonch and Hollow and another whole set of characters who we see here. The first real change of the guard since season 5 in 83 when Zamo and Faye Lucas, who takes lead vocal on the track, by the way, and Roland, etc., were introduced. So we do have all these new characters in Grange Hill at the moment.
Sarah, did you partake or were you banned?
I dabbled, I guess. I never really got into it. I suppose I was too young at this time and then I sort of missed it. I would sort of watch it out of one eye occasionally. Yeah. I didn't have the best time at school, and so I don't really want to be reminded of it when I was not at school, I suppose. But it definitely gives you that atmosphere of like, it's a bit you know, the lawless zones of the stairwells and things.
When it first started, I was still at junior school, and it was around about that time where it was like, oh, you're going to big school soon, kids shove your head down the toilet every day, and people were making it sound really grim, and you look at Grange Hill and go, oh, actually it's not that bad. But when you do get to school, it's like, oh, God, school's shit.
I got swung round by my ponytail once by another girl. And that was something. I mean, you wouldn't, if you saw that on Grange Hill, you go, nah, it can't be. But yeah, that was, I was, even as I was going round in a circle and passing out, I was impressed. It's like, you've got to be strong.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, Grange Hill, for the first kind of few years, it's like Scum for kids, basically. You know, it's all about fear and which is a big component of school, but it was slightly overstressed in those early series.
I mean, it's Phil Redmond, Sir Phil Redmond, if you please, who is, you know, an important writer who gave us obviously the first on-screen pre-Watershed lesbian kiss in Brookside and also crashed a fucking plane into Emmerdale. So, like, you know, that was him. So he definitely had a yen for disaster in that way.
It was a bit of an imitation Edmonds, because in the Grange Hill annuals, he always banged on about his helicopter. And it's like, oh, yeah, I have to go, you know, I work in Liverpool, and so when I have to go to film for Grange Hill, I'll get into my helicopter. My helicopter's brilliant. I mean, obviously, he's just saying, well, you know, loads of lads are reading this. What are they interested in? Oh, yeah, helicopters. I'll talk about that all the time. But, yeah, he used to fucking bang on about his helicopter. All right, mate, we know you've got an helicopter.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's loosening his grip, if you like, on Grange Hill at this point.
Yeah.
I think his last kind of concrete act here is putting Ziggy in this, the Scouse character, always seemed like a really unlikely pupil at Grange Hill.
It prepares us for the moving of the whole fucking school to Liverpool.
Oh, God, yeah.
At the end, which is mental. That's on a par with Bobby in Dallas coming to and realising it was all a dream. Oh, we're actually all in Liverpool now, are we? Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a period. It's in transition. Loads of new characters. Vince Savage, this kind of gormless troglodyte. Robbie Wright, Trevor Cleaver. Mr. Bronson makes his first appearance in this series.
Godlike Mr. Bronson.
Yeah, and you've got sort of a new set of girls in Grange Hill. Callie Donington and her mate Ronnie Birtles and Laura Reagan. They're the ones, by the way, who do the don't listen to anyone else bit in the song. Ant Jones. He's kind of got a really big bouffant haircut. Looks
Ant
a bit
Jones,
like a,
yes.
Yeah, he's undoubtedly a reflection of George Michael, I think.
Yeah, oh, he's definitely there as the heartthrob of Grange Hill.
Yeah, and he delivers, of course.
The new stew pot.
Yeah. And he delivers the line, all you got to do is be yourself, in the song.
Oh, he's so serious about it.
Let's talk about the video then, because it starts with Zamo in an extremely old school gym while some youth attempts to sell the drugs to a very young John Alford. So, you know, an intervention's made. And then immediately we whip to the past because we see Tucker Jenkins, the fucking Don of Grange Hill, DJing a youth club disco, which Danny Kendall being dragged to, with shots of youths walking up corridors with their arms around each other trying to make it feel like the Breakfast Club. And then Faye Lucas, who appears to have come as someone's nan in a pink cardigan, starts emoting at the mic in a studio with Kendall, Imelda Davis, who was the gripperette of the current series, and of course Roland and his helpful nemesis Janet.
Yeah, but the thing is, they're all getting along, right?
Yes.
And I recall one of the things I immediately didn't like about this video at the time is that all the dynamics of the actual show just kind of absconded completely. In the video, everyone's friends and everyone joins in.
We're seeing the cast, not the characters.
Yeah, I know, but it's the way that they pick up Danny Kendall on the stairs and he's just part of the fun. I hated Danny Kendall. Yeah. He was one of the nastiest, most hateful characters.
Oh, I thought he was a brilliant character. It was surprising that it was Zamo who got into smack and not Danny Kendall.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But that's partly why this is such a profoundly... I think there are many reasons why this is a profoundly uncomfortable watch, but it's partly because even not having the deep knowledge of Grange Hill, it's like, are they in character or are they out of character? Yeah. It's like this sort of no man's land between the two, and they don't know. I mean, they're actors, you know, I think they're kind of going, I'm not really sure what we're supposed to be doing here, and they're doing their best.
Mm. Exactly, and because Zamo's like that, you know, he's just gone through this drug ordeal.
He's still going through it.
Yeah, I mean, him warding off this kid at the beginning
and
telling him to just say no with real earnestness, the kid kind of looks guilty in a sense. Whereas, you know, any kid having Zamo lecturing them would just say, fuck off, Zamo, you hypocrite.
He does sell it, though, to be fair. Just say no! Yeah. Like, he really gives it. And everyone else, that you know, just say no is repeated, I didn't count, but I don't know, 30 times in the following 3 minutes, and no one else looks like they mean it.
I mean, the thing is, it does look like it's in a school, right? It's got that typical Grange Hill staircase.
Yeah.
Which always reminds me, you know expulsion legends at school where you'd hear that a kid had been expelled and you didn't know why, and then you found out. There was a kid called Billy Woodhead in my school. I remember going to his house once and he had a massive knife collection. He was a bit of a badden. but I remember hearing a legend because he just suddenly disappeared from school and everyone was wondering where he was and why he got kicked out. And it turned out he chucked our headmaster, who was called Taff. He chucked him down the stairs. It was a legend. Oh, wait. And there were stairs very, very much like the ones that we see here.
Oof.
So, yeah, no, but Sarah's completely correct. It doesn't quite know. Yes, it's the cast of Grange Hill. Yes, I know we've been told that. But it's kind of uncomfortably on the edge.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, Danny Kendall, he would be dealing. He'd be chopping out Roland's first line of coke. Mm. It annoyed me because it kind of perpetuated that school disco fiction that everyone gets along on the last day of school.
That's bollocks, isn't it?
It is bollocks. Mm. Although, the school disco parts of the video are fairly realistic. I mean, I don't recall the light show at our school disco being quite so spectacular. It was more like my sister's game of disco lights at my school. But what happens next, the gym bits.
We cut back to the youth club with Annette Furman, I think. Is it Annette Furman? Because she left at the end of the last series.
I think it is, though. Yeah,
right.
I think,
well, that makes no sense. And Ant Jones, who's clearly being pitched as the heartthrob of the programme, when he sings, all you got to do is be yourself. It's the most self-conscious bit of singing since Morrissey was accidentally booked onto Soul Train.
He's just, the sort of the gently half-closed eyes and the sort of the gentle tipping of the head to and fro, like he's really, really getting into it and into the idea. He's lining himself up for that career, isn't he?
If I'd have been a few years younger and watching Grange, I would have fucking hated him.
Oh, yeah.
But obviously being popular with girls.
It was direct George Michael influence, I think. on his entire look and his presence in that show.
And then they show us all the fun things that we could be doing instead of taking drugs, including dancing in leotards if you're a girl, or gawping at girls dancing in leotards if you're a boy, or shaking your ass in front of a big mirror, or being in a gym. Mm. The musk of the kids from Faye still lingers over the music scene in 1986, doesn't it?
I think that's really directly taken from the American version as well. Yeah. Like the whole kind of aesthetic and the whole like Kids from Fame, which obviously the American version does better. This is like, I mean,
they've got better gyms, aren't there, for a kickoff?
Well, yeah, but there's like the little, you know, advert version from the States, and they're all out in the street like in Fame, and it's a much more diverse, you know, like basically everything about the UK version is sort of, it's a really close analog, but about 70% whiter. I would say
yes,
it's setting up like physical exercise and expression as like the antidote, really. But that's what you do instead of drugs. We know that you're like, you've got an urge to do something, why don't you do aerobics in the disco? And there is like a little dance routine within the school disco, which, like you said, is more realistic apart from that, because everyone's just like shuffling about in that way that you do before you understand how to move your limbs at all, you know. The pinnacle of the discomfort of this video, I think, is seated within the little hand gesture, which would have got you beaten to some sort of jelly if you ever used it yourself, to just say no. And you can see them
I'm glad you brought that up, Sarah, because, you know, up until this morning, I would have just sat there and sneered at you, more or less, and said, oh, well, obviously, Sarah, they're doing sign language. Because deaf kids need to be warned about drugs as well. I mean, they do this series of hand gestures where they ball their fists up and cross them over really quickly before sweeping the right hand away. And for nearly 35 years, I've assumed that they're doing sign language in order to get the hearing impaired youth up to speed. But I checked on the internet to see how accurate it was, because I'm that thorough. And it's all bollocks. It's all absolute bollocks. According to the British Sign Language Dictionary, okay, we can all do this at home now. If you want to say no to a drug dealer but can't be bothered to talk to them, here's how you go about it, right? So just is bringing up the left hand in a pincer movement like you were picking a pear from a tree.
Okay.
Right? All right.
Say is pointing to your chin with your left index finger and then throwing it out to the person you're talking to. And no is shaking your head and bringing the flat of your palms out like Tommy Cooper, right? So we can safely say that the cast of Grangeville are not doing that at all, are they?
Oh, man.
No, they're
that
not.
That would have been much better.
Because I'm extra thorough, I thought, oh, hang on a minute, this is an American song and they're ripping off an American video. So I went over and checked the American Sign Language Dictionary, because they have a different way of going about with sign language, because they're awkward cunts who think the summer. Which means that if you're British and deaf, and you bump into a deaf American person, you can't talk to each other.
No.
That's fucking mental.
Such a silly country.
But anyway, so I checked their sign language dictionary, and it's even less like what the youths of Grangeville are doing. So that raises the question, why? Why are they doing that? And who told them to do that?
Yeah. Somebody's devised that.
Yeah.
The shittest illegal paper, rock, scissors move ever. Somebody has thought about that.
Paper, scissors, rock, no. Like, you can see that they're all, like, giggling in this quite endearing way, because it was either that or cringe themselves literally inside out.
Because they all get it wrong. Some of them do it with the left hand, some of it doing with the right hand. Some of them, you can see them bashing their fists together and laughing about it. So, yeah, it's fucking stupid. So if there are any pop-crazed youngsters out there who are conversant in sign language, I'm begging you, please look at the video available on the video playlist and tell us what they're actually signing, if anything. Because for all I know, someone on the film crew could have got them to sign Hail Lord Satan or Heroin is Skill just for the laugh. Very strange.
Oh my God, that's like Four Weddings, where she learned sign language so she can flirt with the deaf guy. And it's like, would you like to dance? That would be mice.
It doesn't help that the gym bits, I mean, they happen over perhaps one of the most sort of objectionable 80s sax solos, this side of Kenny Loggins' The Danger Zone, really. It's, and I think Sarah's right. Undoubtedly, this is a nod back to Kids from Fame a little bit.
Yes.
But because it's kids in their pants, pretty much, in a gym, it can't help coming across like the opening of that Thermal Cock Sex Ed video, which I still can't erase from my mind. But, I mean, crucially, you know, if you're a young adult who this video is presumably trying to reach, this model of health and efficiency provided by the cast, it's vile and unsexy and unexciting and nothing you really want to get involved in.
And then, because it's the mid-80s, we get the sole British contribution to the song, Some Rap, performed by Mulky Krister, and I've said that wrong and I do apologise to him, who played Kevin Balon, mainly because he's the one black male in Grainshaw. He's this season's Benny, isn't he?
Yeah.
So what was it made you do it? You had no need. First a taste, then a craving, then it turned to greed. Calling me your main man, you didn't really understand. After all you did to me, expecting me to shake your hand. No! There we go.
I love how it's that sort of proto John Barnes flow, you know, catch me if you can, because I'm the heroin man. Three lines on my desk, I know we can't go wrong.
Get round here for some crack.
That bridge, the don't listen. It's been in my head for weeks. My brain just keeps defaulting to it. I'll be there just trying to, like, you know, make a cup of tea. Don't listen. You know, I have to hand it to them. It's not a very good song, but that is a very catchy hook.
You're right, Sarah. It is catchy.
And yeah, we end back at the youth club with the girls doing some proper Kids from Faming with a stop motion jump and kick. They missed a trick in this video, because what they should have put in to really drive the message home is Mr. Bronson dressed up as a hippie in a fucking Jethro Tull t-shirt with a spliff on, giving the peace sign and playing a guitar solo through it.
Yeah,
that would have been mint.
How could they have done this better? Like, because it seems neither one thing nor another, it's kind of not in universe, it's not in the real world either. Like, how could they? I mean, they would have had to either go comedy, like go full on kind of slapstick silliness, or go much
darker.
There's
nothing funny about drugs, Sarah.
Well, yeah, so they couldn't ever have done that. So, but this is the thing, I feel like this is a compromise born of just the sheer awkwardness of, like, well, how do you fit this into that? And how does this go with it? And you just kind of, it seems like it should be logical, but once you start, and I've done so many, like, little kind of copywriting jobs like this, where they go, we want this idea in there, but you want it through this prism, and there's, and it's like, no, that isn't.
And we want it to go viral as well.
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, I used to fucking hate that. Oh, yeah, we want to do this thing, but, and we really want it to go viral.
Can you make a viral video?
And so I'd think, well, yeah, okay, then, get your managing director to stand outside a school with no trousers or pants on, doing Hitler salutes, and then eating his own shit out of an ice cream tub. That'll go viral.
That'll do it.
It won't cost you much either, apart from bail.
What's really weird as well, you know, when in researching this for CMP, I did the thing immediately, Google a lyric.
Yes.
And I couldn't find any.
I know.
The shame is so deep around this record that, you know, it can't even be rehabilitated in any way. It also needs saying that the actual central lyrical conceit here, just say no, right? How rude.
Yeah.
Just say, no, thank you. No, thank you. You know? Very rude.
Yeah, and the idea that all you gotta do is be yourself. So a 14-year-old whose fucking hormones are going berserk, the last thing they can do is be themselves. They're turning into this fucking beast with the hair where there wasn't before.
Well, I mean, what if being yourself is taking shitloads of drugs? Or,
yes.
I mean, or conversely, you know, what if being yourself is living in a tiny shit old town with no friends and nothing to do? You know, it's a weird message, be yourself, for kids, because it reminds you as a kid, as Sarah hinted, you know, yourself is precisely sometimes who you don't want to be. And it's this recurrent bloody message that you take drugs to fit in, like everyone's a junkie zombie out there.
Yeah, but peer pressure.
Well, you do drugs precisely not to fit in, you know, with a true zombification of capitalism or whatever you're thinking about at that time. And I remember very soon after this, there was one of those Smith & Jones talking heads. And Mel Smith goes, it's a great campaign, you know, it just means that if a copper asks you if you've got any drugs, you just say no.
I mean, really, in this case, just say no It's no different to Marie Antoinette saying, just eat cake, or that mad woman in the cabinet saying, just eat turnips.
I mean, yeah, it is. I mean, oh God, this is all stuff I could rant about all the live long day, drugs or no drugs. But it is going to be more complicated than that. Mm. It's so insultingly reductive to just say no. I mean, yeah, like you said, if it's about peer pressure and the delicate sort of social ecosystem of school, just barking a refusal at someone who might be trying to bring you into their group. Yeah. Through, you know, in the way that friends might do, it's not necessarily like, ha-ha, I've got drugs, I'm going to corrupt you with them. You know, it's like, well, maybe we want you to be our mate. It's just we think you're sound. And it's like, no, this is not going to be good for you. However bad drugs are for you, that's not good either.
No. Oh, God, I'm doing it now. No, thank you.
I mean, also the weird slippage that you get with this, with the message and the song and the video is like, yeah, most of the lyrics that you can hear are just really vaguely about, like I said, that kind of social ecosystem of school and about the kind of dynamic between people, I think. They obviously kind of swerved being really explicit about it. But you just end up nowhere. And it's like, well, are you talking about being yourself, which you might not want to be? You might want to go, Jesus Christ. Well, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
B, no.
Yeah. I mean, don't listen to anyone else. All you got to do is be yourself. For all we know, God might have said that to Peter Sutcliffe in that graveyard in Polish.
Yeah.
It's
that,
so
that
fucking
is,
vague, isn't it?
It is.
That's not necessarily a good thing.
No.
I'm not saying British people shouldn't do American stuff.
That is true a lot of the time, though.
It is. But, I mean, it's still a mawkish pile of shit, this record, in its American iteration. But it would have been a professional-sounding mawkish pile of shit, probably with a fabulously appointed video. I mean, because it's British, and because it's the living version of, you know, the front cover of the Come and Praise Hymn book, i.e. the Grange Hill cast, it's this weird thing of this rub between this attempted professionalism, but just this endless amateurishness that, as a kid, you would just find, I mean, I guess what you'd say now is totally cringe. And I showed this to Sophia, and she literally cringed herself inside out. She couldn't watch it. So the cringe factor in this just hasn't gone away, and this is why it failed.
So you did see, like, the American version, didn't you? Whatever,
yeah,
there was a clip of it on
Drug Watch. Yeah.
It was much tighter, and, you know, it still had the kind of slightly unpleasant sax. Not that I'm completely anti-sax, but it was, you know, it's not the best. It's not the best use of the controversial instrument.
You practice safe sax, don't you, Sarah?
Absolutely, always. But, yeah, it wasn't funky, but it was funkier. There was a whiff of funk about it, at least. You know, it's a whiff of the street.
Yes.
Which is, you know, there is no whiff of the street here whatsoever.
No.
It is the damp indoor air of a comprehensive school.
Obviously, chaps, Lee McDonald, Zamo, is the centrepiece of the entire operation. I mean, Zamo's got another series in him. The next one focuses on his rehabilitation and his reunion with Jackie Wright. But Lee, the actor, has an eye on the future, as a Daily Mirror article at the end of the year spells out. Headline, next to him posing with Frank Bruno, Frank and Fearless. I'm ready to be a champion, says TV's junkie kid. Pocket-sized TV star Zamo is a knockout with Grange Hill fans, and Lee McDonald, who plays the drug-taking sixth-former in the hit BBC series, is aiming to pull no punches in real life. The 18-year-old Lee is a brilliant amateur boxer with his sights set on a place in the British team for the 1988 Olympics in Seoul. Lee has no fears about combining acting and boxing. I'm going to keep boxing until I'm 21. Then, if I'm good enough, I'll turn professional. I love boxing and I love acting, and I want to keep both going for as long as possible. That's why I've also applied for a place at drama school. My ambition is to get a part in EastEnders. But Lee still finds time to enjoy himself. I go out with my mates from Grange Hill every Friday and Saturday night, says the chirpy cockney. We're all VIP members of the Hippodrome, Stringfellows and the Limelight, so we're there almost every weekend. Absolutely no chance of coming across anybody with any drugs in those places, is there? I mean, before we go any further, chaps, because we've only just scratched the surface of this, we have to absolve the cast of Grange Hill first. suffer any responsibility for this shit. Because, you know, it's pretty obvious that they weren't allowed to say no when it came to the recording of this.
I mean, people fucking bought it. That's what I can't quite fathom out.
If you're a certain age and you hear that Castor Grange Hill are making a record, you're going to buy it, aren't you?
I guess so.
And you know the BBC are shoving it up at every child's arse on the telly at the moment.
Incessantly, yeah. Incessantly. Perhaps why it fails. But, I mean, why it fails is because, I mean, the whole campaign fails, Drug Watch, and also the It's Not Just Zammo Newsround special.
Yeah, we do need to talk about why it failed. But before that, why are Grange Hill and the government and all the advertising campaigns just focusing on heroin? Because there's other drugs about.
I think it's possibly something to do with, you know, it being a drug of deprived areas and stuff, because then that's a nice, neat way to kind of put the personal responsibility on you to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, because then you don't actually have to do anything like build good houses or anything like that.
Yeah, that's really important.
Also, I think it's that heroin, because we've never had like meth in this country in a big way, and heroin was always that. I think it was just like the ultimate drugs. You know, it's like the worst.
The boss level of drugs.
Yeah, it's the end of level boss of drugs. You know what I mean? It's just got that. I don't know if where that came from, but I think it's just sort of got this mythos around it.
Mm.
I've got to say, I don't know anyone in my entire life who's done heroin. That's been the one drug that everyone's just kept away from.
Oh, God.
But it's not a party drug, is it?
No, it isn't.
No. I mean, I know a couple of people who have tried it once in order to, because you can actually do that, you know, contrary to a lot of...
Don't listen to Sarah Popcrazy. No,
she's
not
right.
Her.
She's completely right.
Don't listen to... It is, as I understand it... Okay, I feel like I should do a caveat, which is that, you know, we are sticking our asses way out of our remit for this this podcast in some ways. And, you know, none of us are drug or drug policy experts, just people who've done some and lived.
That was the problem, Sarah, because the way they were going on about drugs, not so much in this video, but on the advertising, you know, the heroin screws you up. It's like, you take this, you die eventually.
Yeah. You will.
And that was the problem, because a few years later, you know, my mates and eventually me started dabbling. It's like, oh, shit, I'm still alive. They were all talking bollocks.
Well, that's absolutely it, yeah.
Yeah, I had a sort of similar thing when I was, you know, I mean, later even than, you know, slow coach Kulkarni, who didn't do any drugs until he was 16.
God.
My God. That's so lame. But, I was, you know, 18 or something. And when I was at university and the whole Leah Betts thing happened, and that was, I think I've spoken about it before. And those big posters with her smiling face and the black and the white kind of grainy thing, and it's like sorted. Just one ecstasy tablet took Leah Betts, and I had the fear of God put into me about this. And then when I actually did it, and I had two kind of failed attempts, because I wanted to try the thing, but I was terrified, and that actually, because it is quite sensitive to your moods, and I think I probably had bad stuff to start with anyway, so I had a pill and then just spent several hours just going, I'm gonna die. And I did not die. And then I didn't die the second time. I didn't have a nice time either. And the third time I did it, I had an amazing time, which is the whole point.
Yeah.
And then the next day I wake up and you pat yourself down and go,
yeah,
I didn't die. Ah!
Yeah.
It's quite a cliche, really, but you do then start to question what you've been told in the larger sense. Like, okay, why has there been money spent to terrify me and stop me and make me fear that I'm going to die to stop me from doing this? And obviously it's like, that's your personal experience, that it's a hugely complex, large thing. But your personal experience is to go, what else am I being lied to about? And it's that's where it goes. And so that's why you start to understand it's not just about the drugs.
Yeah.
It's not just about how much they care about whether you live or die. It's about bigger stuff than that.
Yeah. I mean, look, up until you have your first drug experience, or up until you experience drugs for yourself, these kind of campaigns, they do work in a sense, because they put this terror in you. The nature of a moral panic is, as Sarah's hinted, that it completely ignores, obviously, this entire campaign, the sort of systemic complex reasons why there's a lot of drug use in this country. It tries to instill this almost Pavlovian response to drugs, that, like, you know, you see the word heroin, and it's terrifying. And you know, once I ended up, I mean, look, I didn't end up in the shooting gallery or anything. All I mean is, once I ended up sat in a room and somebody was doing some heroin, yes, I thought, God, that looks really squalid, and I didn't want to do it.
What made you want to do it? You had no need.
But, you know, I mean, it's something I think about a lot, because I have to have these conversations, in a sense, not only with kids that I teach, but also my own kids.
Yeah.
But crucially, it's a conversation, you know?
Yeah.
Because no one wants teenage kids to be doing anything adulterated, you know what I mean?
Well, no, no. I mean, look, what Drug Watch is doing, what Just Say No is trying to do, is, yeah, it's like a Pavlovian dog. It's this. It's like when you go to get hypnotised to stop smoking or something. They just kind of repeat this phrase until it's so in your head that would ward you away. But out of the moral panics of the 80s, I guess the Americans had satanic panic and we had this.
Yes.
But both of them just ignore the really complex reasons, because that's messy and difficult and you know, takes time. They'd rather just kind of, it's almost like this kind of idiot training. Just Say No, Just Say No. Let's just keep saying that until kids don't do it.
Yeah.
It's behavioural conditioning is what it is.
That's it.
And it's perfect in its way, in the sense that it's a total abdication of any greater responsibility. And because it puts it completely on the individual to... it's so, you know, it's so simple. Just say no. And then if you don't do that and you get yourself into some trouble with the law or with your health... should have just said no. I mean,
yeah, expecting me to shake your hand. Just Say No. It's essentially government saying, look, we're getting our arses kicked in the war on drugs, and there are things we could do to deal with it, like, you know, legalizing some drugs and making their use as safe as possible and you know, taxing the shit out of it to keep the NHS going.
No.
But we're not going to do that. So if you actually take drugs and it all goes wrong, it's all your fault, mate.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I hesitate to draw this parallel with recent events, but the same kind of personal responsibility absolutism that has given us some of the highest drug death numbers in Europe also gave us some of the highest COVID death numbers in the world. Because for me personally, like, I've risked my health outside the law for a good time, and I've risked my health inside the law for a good time. And guess which one had the life-altering consequences? In each case, it's like, it's all on the individual to do the best risk assessment that they can with really scant information. This is the thing as well, as the kind of withholding of information, which still happens now. Like, there's been some progress on this with kind of drug testing at festivals and things like that. And I mean, the Talk to Frank website, which is kind of better than nothing, just about, although I'm not sure how often it's being updated now. But basically, you don't have, you know, you were saying earlier about, like, oh, you could, you know, if you study this, you were allowed access to the book with all the stuff in it about drugs. It's like, well, why is that restricted in the first place? You know, it's, well, because Just Say No. Why would you need any of that when you could just say no? Like, the thing is, it has been proven as a policy which came from America, and then we adopted it ourselves in a kind of vague but persistent way. It's been proven not to work. What works is, you know, actual education, actual information, and talking more about it and in a more nuanced and non-judgmental way. That's what actually works, but that's more expensive. So it doesn't work, but it works because people want it to, because people believe in it at some really, like, primal level. And so it's never going to go away, I don't think, because it's too, like I said, it's just too perfect. Well, just say no, but it doesn't work. But it has to, but just say no.
I mean, if I tried saying to, like, my daughters, just say no. I mean, starters, that's not a conversation, you know, that's just me telling them to do that.
Yeah.
When you're talking about drugs with kids, you know, you have to realise that drugs are a part of their life, even if they don't take them, because their friends will be taking them. I mean, you know, kids at secondary school now are doing things at the weekend, right, that their adult parents are doing. And it's pointless me saying to my daughter, just say no, just don't do anything. I have to say the sensible, I mean, perhaps this isn't the sensible thing, but what I've said to my daughters is, you know, never pay for anything apart from weed. And look, just be fucking careful. You cannot destroy that impulse to get out of your head.
No.
Or to get out of your face. You cannot destroy that simply by saying you don't need that in your life. You know, go to the gym instead.
Yes.
So it has to be, crucially, it has to be a conversation.
Get some proper steroids there, mate.
Well, exactly.
Human growth hormone.
I mean, It is very telling, isn't it, that the boxing gym and the gym always seems to be the solution. But yeah, I mean,
instead of damaging your brain, damage someone else's.
But crucially, none of this campaign, either in the States or over here, is a conversation. It's not a conversation. It's hectoring.
Yeah.
It's abstinence, isn't it? It's abstinence only, which doesn't work any better for drugs than it does for sex, because these are natural urges.
No.
The terrible thing about Just Say No is that, of course, it's going to work for some people.
Yeah.
Mm. Some people would have been like me and they would have seen that Leah Betts poster and gone, no. No, thank you. Or some variation on that, and just not tried it ever at all. But, you know, I had the urge, and I was not a kid then. I was, you know, a young adult. And I was extremely sensible, and I was very cautious. And, you know, and it wasn't about peer pressure, and it wasn't about any of these other things. It was just like, I want to know.
Yeah.
And that's something that is really difficult for people and societies to deal with, but it is not going away.
No.
And a lot of great things can come out of that.
Indeed.
I don't want to come on here going, yeah, drugs, because, you know, I'm not a dickhead. Like, I understand that this is a huge issue and it can really destroy people's lives. I mean, there are at least three artists in this episode of Top of the Pops alone whose lives have been blighted by drugs, you know, including Zamo, who survived. But, you know, it's scary, really, to think that this is still really, this is nearly 40 years later, and we haven't significantly moved on from this.
No,
good God, no. The message is still the same, isn't it?
The only thing that's moved on is the drugs.
Yeah.
If Grainger was still going today and they did an anti-drug song, the first question would be, well, okay, what drugs should we focus on? The crappy ones like the nitrous oxide or crocodile or something like that.
We should say, actually, as we're recording at this time, the government has announced that as part of a crackdown on antisocial behaviour, they're criminalising the possession of nitrous oxide or laughing gas, which was already illegal to manufacture or supply under the Psychoactive Substances Act of 2016, which I remember laughing about grimly when it happened.
Mm.
It's one of those impossible pieces of legislation that doesn't make a lick of sense.
No.
Because it's like, okay, any novel substance that, you know, because they were trying to deal with legal highs, which obviously were a huge problem. They had to do something, but not this, you know, because you could say scented candles, if they make you, if they give you a nice sense memory of when you were 12 and you went to the beach, like anything that makes you feel a feeling at all, no, just say no.
And all political parties have to do that. They have to talk tough constantly about this issue. I mean, Labour last week, we're talking about, oh yeah, these poor families who smell a bit of weed in their back garden or whatever, as if it's the end of the world. And yeah, this talking tough rhetoric, it's never going to go.
Mm.
You know, and this is why every now and then you'll get a politician asked whether they've done weed, and all of them seemingly, you know, didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and it's just the maintenance of that tone constantly means we're not going to go anywhere with this issue.
No.
You're not crediting the kids with anything. You're not crediting the kids with their own reconnaissance, in a sense. The only way to really find out about drugs is to live, ultimately, to live into your 20s, where these things become part of your life.
Mm.
Not part of your life on a daily basis. I just mean you get exposed to the realities of drugs rather than this nonsense that governments have to shoot out.
Mm.
The thing is, one of the many, many insulting and patronising ideas that persists is the kind of casual user to addict pipeline, which it's a different thing. That's insulting to both people who struggle with addiction and to casual users, because these are, of course, one can, you know, you don't become an addict without first being a casual user, but being a casual user does not necessarily mean that you're going to end up, you know, dribbling in an alley behind a bin with a needle in your arm. That's not how it works. I mean, I was going to say, like I said, not being an expert, but I do understand that heroin specifically, it's legendarily addictive, and it is very addictive, but it's not like you have one go and you're like, oh, that's me, that's my life.
Mm.
It takes you a while to get physically addicted to it. I think if you like it, then you're going to feel addicted to it sooner than your body starts to need it. But there's a reason for that. Drugs are a solution before they are a problem. They're a solution to a larger problem where people have pain or grief or just they're lost in some way. And that's often why, you know, there will be reasons, there'll be psychological reasons why people end up in that. You know, like I said, it's very complicated.
The psychological and hereditary and social reasons for drug use just they're not a part of any of these campaigns at all.
No.
But going back to the mid-80s, I mean, about a year after this episode, Zamo became the absolute byword for a custard gannet or anyone knew who did drugs. I mean, by the end of this year, I'd started going to another college and I started to mix with kids from the posh end of town, all on the hash and everything. And, you know, my working class background just prevented me from tucking into the drugs because it was just like, no, we don't do this shit. They'd be there having a spliff and pass it over to me and I'd immediately say, no thanks, mate. I saw what it did to Zamo.
I get high on life.
Yes. Yeah, and round about that time, some of the dancers in my year at college did a show somewhere in town, and they were supported by a nearby comprehensive school who'd done a musical about the drug problem, set in a school where even the dinner ladies were dealing hash on the side. And I wish I could remember every second of it, but the only thing I can remember is near the middle, where the female central character just appears under a spotlight and sings a song which sounded not dissimilar to a little piece by Nicole. Mm-hmm. And the opening lines were, I'm so depressed and I don't know why. I'm hooked on drugs and I'm going to die. And my entire class just sliding off their chairs, pissing themselves laughing. Oh, I wish I could remember more about it. I wish there was someone out there who was in that musical to tell us all about it. And so I can apologise to them for just laughing so derisively at them.
No.
By the time I got to university and was living with a load of custard gannets, we did have in the window of our shared house a picture of Zamo, which had been ripped out of the Grange Johannion. And someone had cut his eyes out and done a bit of a spirograph of them.
I mean, that's the thing. This isn't a song or anything that sort of like took time to pass into joke folklore.
No.
It was a joke as soon as it appeared. The people it was trying to reach just laughed at it.
And of course, Top of the Pulse feeling very pleased with itself and lecturing the kids, you know, just a couple of years before they play, they call it acid.
Mm-hmm. He's a good. He's Ebenezer.
Yes.
I was in an office. I was doing a social copywriting job a few years ago and Radio 1 was on in the office and everyone there was much younger than me. And Ebenezer Good came on and it's like, is this real?
Yeah.
They couldn't believe it. It's like, what? This was a real record that people bought it and it was in the charts and stuff. I was like, yeah. They were just like, what?
Why didn't anybody do a fucking crappy rave version of this?
Yeah.
I would have sold a fucking shitload.
In that period where some of this stuff was getting parodied and stuff in rave chains, it would have been big.
And someone else should have done a cover of The Firm's tune, Off a Day Later, He's All Right.
Opportunity missed.
Oh, yeah. Imagine what's going on in the universe where that happened.
So, the following week, Just Say No soared 21 places to number 5, where it stayed for 2 weeks. It ended up selling 250,000 copies in the UK, and the cast were congratulated in the House of Parliament for covering their sorry arses in the fight against drugs, and they appeared outside the Adelphi Theatre in October, forming a big no, Good Morning Britain opening credits style. Article in The Guardian. Members of the cast of TV's Grange Hill spell out their view of drugs. No! They will be joining show business stars in the Just Say No gala evening at the Adelphi Theatre to raise cash for drug counselling centres. Others who have agreed to appear include Sasha Distel, Wayne Sleep, Alvin Stardust, kids, you must be out of your tiny minds, John Inman, Don McLean and members of the casts of Emmerdale Farm and Coronation Street. Wow. Well, that's going to put some sense into the kids, isn't it? Sasha Distel, Just Say No.
The kids from Grange Hill, I think some of them turn up in Fairy Aid in a couple of years. So this isn't the last time, you know?
And emboldened by the chart success of Just Say No, Phil Redmond, creator of the show, hustled his cast back into the studio to record Grange Hill, the album. Album, a mixture of medleys and original material. Are you ready for the track list?
Oh, yes, please.
You Know the Teacher, open brackets, Smash Head, close brackets. girls like to do it too.
That ain't right.
The it turns out to be bullying.
Yes.
led by Imelda Davis. Phew.
Yeah. Do you collect stamps?
Yes.
No. Just say no.
We also have school love. No supervision at break. Biology. This sounds like a fucking Gary Glitter or Jonathan King album, doesn't it?
I wonder if School Love is a cover of the Anvil tune. School Love, that would be amazing. And I now need to hear that, because that's a tune, man.
Just say no, of course. Don't stop. A lad's medley, which includes My Generation, The Walk of Life, The Wanderer, and Rocking All Over the World. Aunt Jones performing I Don't Like Mondays.
Oh, what? Do they know what that's about?
Then there's a girls' medley, which includes What a Wonderful World, Sweet Nothings, Why Do Fools Fall in Love, and Da Do Ron Ron, and a medley of The Greatest Love of All, and That's What Friends Are For.
Wow.
I hope Roland and Janet sang them too.
Oh, my God.
But it, and the single taken from it, You Know the Teacher, Smashhead, failed to chart. But later this year, the cast of Grange Hill were whipped over to Washington, D.C. to appear with Nancy Reagan at the White House for a special Just Say No Day, with Zamo sat next to the First Lady and Faye Lucas presenting her with a 12-inch of Just Say No, which, according to Lee McDonald, she lobbed under the sofa, forgot about at the end and just walked off, presumably to have it off with Frank Sinatra again. 10 weeks after this episode was broadcast, the tabloids announced that heroin was back and collaborating with Boy George. Yeah, Junkie George has 6 weeks to live. And after falling out of favour and being superseded by ecstasy in the late 80s, heroin made a comeback when it teamed up with a sort of grunge and Britpop acts in the early 90s before working with the Libertines, and is still going today. And by recording this single, the cast of Grange Hill slapped a target on their back. In 1999, John Alford failed to heed Samo's instructions in the gym and was convicted of supplying drugs to the fake sheikh, Mazir Mahmood of the News of the World, and jailed for 6 weeks. Round about the same time, Erkan Mustafa, who played Roland Browning, was caught in another sting by the Sunday Mirror when he offered to get them heroin, cocaine and ecstasy, claimed he was making £900 a night selling drugs in his club, and bragged that he and the cast smuggled drugs into America and he was ripped to the tits in the White House, which he later said was all bollocks, and it bit him fiercely in the arse. He also claimed in that Sunday Mirror interview that he went to Top of the Pops off his face to mime the song, which is absolute bollocks because the two appearances of this single were the screening of the video. And in the mid-90s, the journalist Taylor Parks was in the green room of The Word for a Melody Maker article when he chanced upon that week's guests, members of the cast of Grange Hill, running round animatedly, singing Just Say Yes. Just say no, no. Just say no. Tell me we didn't just bang on about Just Say No for nearly an hour and a quarter. Fucking hell. Anyway, we're all off to the gym now to shake our asses in front of a mirror for a bit and do some completely wrong hand gestures at some kids. But we shall return tomorrow for the final part of this episode of Chart Music. Oh, and by the way, do not sleep on the video playlist for this episode, Podcraze youngsters. Everything we've talked about is there in visual form, including that astonishing display of BBC star power at the end of Drug Watch. Anyway, on behalf of Neil Kulkarni and Sarah B, this is Al Needham advising you very strongly to stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi,
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.